Hi, my name is Jamie Ridgway, the head coach and owner of the Renaissance Academy of Martial Arts. And today I want to tell you about some of the programs that we offer at the Academy. So in our Little Dragons programs, our 4 to 6 year old class, that class is designed for, you know, teach kids focus. You know, at that age, it's very difficult for them to focus. So we want to teach them focus. We want to teach them basic tumbling, basic martial arts skills. At the same time, you know, stranger danger, what to do if there's somebody that comes along they don't know and how to act. So we go over all those things, kind of a prep program for kids. We teach a lot of jiu-jitsu in there too. The 7 to 12 year old kids, now they're a little more mature and they're ready to start taking a big piece of the information as far as like martial arts classes. So in that class, we teach them Taekwondo blended with Muay Thai kickboxing, blended with Gracie jiu-jitsu, so that they are well-rounded. They can kick, punch, clinch, and grapple. And that's where, you know, in today's world, we see a lot of self-defense situations end up, is on the ground. So they need to know that too. So when they come out with a junior black belt, not only are they focused, but they're also well-rounded as a martial artist. And you're gonna see things like respect and self-discipline at home through the program, because that's the most important thing that we're teaching the kids. And that is, hey, we don't want them to learn all these skills and not showing respect and saying yes ma'am and no ma'am and doing their chores at home. That's really what it's all about.
Welcome to another episode of The Podyssey. Once again, my name is Obey. I'm your host for today. Guys, we have, man, three of just like one of my greatest friends. I'm just really appreciative of these guys coming on the podcast. First up, we have Damani Smallwood. Damani is 26. He was born and raised in Northern Virginia. He attended, Damani, this is so long. He attended Colonial Forge High School located in Stafford, Virginia. After graduating in 2010, he went on to pursue an associate's degree in liberal arts from Germana Community College. He later attended Liberty University, where he was awarded a Bachelor of Science in Criminal Justice. He's currently pursuing a Master's in Project Management. He enjoys road trips, spending time with his wife, reading, music, politics, and discussions about gravity. That's dope. Just kidding, but not really.
That's dope. My wife wrote this.
Oh, word.
Dang.
That's right. Yeah, it's good. Yeah, it was good.
I don't even
good.
Read mine.
Shamari Dixon, current Future Center Director at Heritage.
Sorry. Are you laughing? Why are you trying?
I'm sorry. Shamari Dixon, he's the current Future Center Director at Heritage High School here in Lynchburg, Virginia. Mm-hmm. He doesn't want you to know anything else about him. He's from New York, so he keeps that thing private.
And New York, show cuts.
Rochester, the one and only Chad Gobar. My dear friend. Yo, I can't eat. Yo, Disney. Chad's making me read this. I'm going to read it.
No, you don't got to read it, bro.
My dear friend is the greatest influence on my blackness. Without him, I'd be grabbing... I'd be grabbing random white people pizza without asking. Shout out Noah Pepper. I wouldn't know the savoriness of hot sauce or the sweet satire of the Boondocks.
You're welcome, bro.
I met Chad during my time at Liberty. At that time, he was studying theology and government. Fast forward a couple years, Chad is 1/7.
There's seven of us.
1/7 of the hip-hop collective called Peace Corps. That's spelled C-O-R-E, Peace Corps.
Services. Download that, junk.
Download that.
They have released two collective projects, Peace Corps Presents, Story Mode, and Seven, which are actually pretty good. Y'all check them out.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
They could be the core.
They can be found.
Before you finish, are you down with the core?
Yeah, you gotta ask that question, bro, before you keep going.
Yes, I'm down with the core.
All right, cool. All right, keep it going. Hey, logo designed by the one and only Shamari Dixon.
That's right.
Forgot to put that in the bio.
My bad.
Y'all hear the rest of the bio they can next 60 minutes. I make sure to drop random things.
But we can't even get to the bios, guys. All right. They can be found on all streaming services. Chad recently finished an internship with the Nate Parker and Kellogg Foundation, which is Nate Parker's doing some great work. If you guys can support his foundation, it's really phenomenal. In which he helps create a docuseries commemorating the 400th year anniversary of the first Africans brought to this country. The HBCU Storytellers Project will begin screening that in the fall. Chad currently spends his days doing freelance video and photography projects, as well as trying to build the Peace Corps brand.
Yeah, so Obey, I love everything you're doing, bro.
Yeah.
But you might want to read through your lines a couple times before you get started with the podcast.
Yeah, that was.
Yeah, I'm just looking out for you.
Strike one. You good?
It's all good though.
You got two more. You good?
Fellas, all right. I felt like I had to get us all back together and to chop it up about, I mean, really anything that we find interesting. So I'm just curious, like, just to warm it up, like, is there anything current events that you guys have found, like, interesting that you've enjoyed talking about and you guys want to talk about?
Trades? Trade
rumors.
Yeah, NBA.
Yo, okay. I was following this, so, it was just so amazing. And I was following it step by step by step. And I cannot believe Shabari's Brooklyn Nets.
Brooklyn.
Like, they just, I don't even know how. I didn't even know Kyrie and KD were talking with all the, they said Kawhi was talking to KD.
Trust the process.
It's about time. It's about time.
Trust the process.
Yo, if Brooklyn does not win it, like, two playoff games, this will be the saddest, like, amount of talent. First off, they don't get KD for a year.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just going to be Kyrie, you lost D'Angelo, you don't care.
Yeah, it was a sign and trade with the Warriors, and the Warriors may not even keep D'Angelo Russell. He can go somewhere else. But the fact is, we got Kyrie, we got Spencer Dinwiddie, we got Caris LeVert.
Who is Spencer Dinwiddie?
Yo, check this guy out.
I got to check him out.
Oh, yeah. Hooper?
Can we get the second Hooper? One as somebody I know already?
Listen, no, these dudes are
DeAndre Jordan. 16. DeAndre Jordan?
He's crazy. Coming from the Knicks, and DeAndre's cool with KD, so it's crazy.
I think the more interesting story is how the Knicks never win.
Oh,
I think that's the more interesting story.
I just feel so, and the memes were so freaking funny.
Dolan,
like
the owner, Dolan.
But the
Knicks, he's awful.
Usually, like, you know, like the Buss family ain't like always got it. I just felt like the name and the brand will always draw people. But maybe we need to start talking about how Madison Square Garden ain't really that place anymore. And because of the way guys are winning championships and their brand is more outside of, like, because it used to be you go to the Knicks and that's how you build your brand.
Mm-hmm.
Now you can build your brand without ever going. You could be on the, I mean, Giannis said, I'm staying with the Bucks in Milwaukee, but that's because he can build his brand without actually having to go to like a big name to build it, which is kind of crazy to me. I'm like, man, so if the Knicks can't just rely on the Knicks brand,
yeah. What's left?
Going to the Garden is just something fun for upper class people to do when you're in the city. And the owner, Dolan, realizes this. He's going to get some special names to say, come check out the show.
Yeah.
But he's, in every sense of the word, an owner. And it's in the same way you look at owning, you know, I'm not going to say slaves, but he's owning... He owns this team, and they're switching the name owner in the NBA now. But he owns this team for the primary purpose
of making money
off of just backs. And we don't care about a championship. That's not important. Let's just get some.
Let's just
headlines.
Let's just keep the niggas happy.
I'm just saying.
Here's my thing. Do you really think that, like, so we got, they're switching the name from owners to what, governors?
That's worse.
Because
That's some colonial shit.
I was like, yo, that has more racial connotations.
Governors does?
Yes, white, rich governors.
I don't know if it has more racial connotation, but it makes, but like owners, we've been living with it for so long, you don't think about it till you think about it in depth.
Right.
But governor, like if they switch that over, that makes me think of like some
governors?
Yeah, some like English, like.
But it doesn't remove the fact that these guys own the team. Like, that's the thing.
Why are they switching the names?
I think it's being switched to managing partner.
Who are they partners with?
But I did hear about governor.
Or managing partner. Even that, I mean.
That's how you know who's making the decisions.
Who? What do you mean?
Like, rich white man. Like, who's going to come up with the name governors? Like could you imagine your auntie being like, we should come up with.
I thought Adam Silver was someone that we all kind of agreed was.
Board of governors, yeah.
He's better than the last one. That doesn't make him.
Okay, I thought the players really liked him. Like, he was cool.
Yeah. Adam Silver?
Yeah, he gets it. That's the whole thing, is Adam Silver is, like, supposed to be this new, like, hip happening. I get it. I let y'all be woke, but also still play like equality. Like, for example, I mean, he's basically keeping the WNBA alive, and he just can't tell the girls we can't afford this. And that's how, and he's just trying to get them profitable. And that's because he cares. He really does believe in that, like, they should be at some point this big, illustrious brand, which I think if he was really about the business, he would move them to smaller markets and let them kind of foster. Like, or he would tell his players, hey, let's just worry about creating a great entertainment value. And sometimes I think that, like, he likes the, like, the political activism. He likes. So I thought he was liked by the players. And that's why I think he was like, yeah, let's change the name. Some of our players are African American. They don't feel comfortable with that. So I think that was probably his decision.
I mean, I have no idea.
What do you call someone who owns an NBA team except an owner?
Yeah,
right. And I don't think it's a negative thing. I mean, because they put up, like, here's the thing. If the players, like, for example, WNBA players, they don't realize, do you want to really put up the money to run it? This is hundreds of millions of dollars before hitting a profit. And a lot of these teams now want all of this investment. And I think they don't realize that, like, for them to ask for these contracts when they, like, who's watching the WNBA? Nobody. Like, I think we got to understand, like, when you're an owner, you're invested in it. Like, it's not like, I understand, like, sometimes owners can be disrespectful. Owners can be, you know, racially disrespectful.
Mm-hmm. But, I mean, if we're going to talk about race and we're going to talk about, like, money that people own and wealth that people have built up, I think you have to remember, like, where that wealth comes from.
So for each owner,
not in a specific each owner, you have made your wealth off of the backs of racism.
Right.
But like the way that race and economics has worked in our country is that, like, up until like 60 years ago, you were a second class citizen. I mean, and some people would still argue you're still a second class citizen. So how do you expect somebody to gain that wealth over time to where they're able to buy a basketball team or buy a football team? You feel what I'm saying?
Doesn't Jay-Z own a part of the?
He does.
He sold it.
He sold it over.
But that's one person. That's one person.
Well, wasn't that because, like, Tidal was like folded and he's like, I need some cash on hand. Like,
I don't know.
Is Tidal still bad? Everybody still using Tidal?
I use Tidal.
You use Tidal?
Yeah.
That's
everything I believe in.
Really?
Yeah. Like, I feel like for Jay-Z to an artist to make a streaming service that gives exclusive content, that gives the top quality music, and he pays artists the most out of the streaming services. Mm-hmm. So if you go and listen to Peace Corps, listen to us on Tidal, please, or buy it. I'm joking. But but honestly, like Jay-Z, someone who started as an artist, pays artists the most amount of money. Like, not only is that an artist owning their music, which for years and years and years, artists didn't own their music, the publishing companies did.
That's true.
And artists were used up and then ended up broke with nothing, but it's also a black man owning his own streaming service.
Right.
So for me, personally, that's two levels that I support. And even though it's $12.99 when iTunes is $9.99, I think that extra $3 should go to what you believe in. Your money should go to what you believe in.
That's definitely.
I thought it was $20.
$20?
No, it's $12.99. There's a ton of misinformation. It's $29 for the high five.
Black people, they'd be like putting out stuff. You'd be like, yo, for the high five. This is for the people. Y'all gotta lower that price.
It's like high quality.
That's like Kanye. Like, yo, I'm making a brand for the people. $1,200 t-shirts. Like, hey man, I'm making a streaming service for the people.
It's going
$25 a month, my guy. I'm gonna take my $4.99 for Spotify.
It's going down though. I mean, the shoes are going down.
I agree with you with that.
Title's going down.
You should give your money to things that you support when you can, and you know, things are important. I just think, like, when we're looking at ownership, I just don't like that, like, we try and make it a negative when, without that amount of wealth and capital put into these teams, like, you wouldn't have what you, the competition and things you, like, if the players really wanted, like, ownership stake, they have to realize they take deficits. So when you're on a losing team and you're the Phoenix Suns, then you lose money. But guess what? If you're the owner, he loses money. You still get paid your $36 million contract. So when, like, what's that dude on the Phoenix Suns? A really nice kid that went to Kentucky. Devin Booker. When Devin Booker dropped 70 and they still lost by 10, like, imagine being the owner. It's like, I got one good person on my team. I'm trying to build a team, but it's going to cost me. This kid's going to want to get paid soon. We ain't selling out any tickets and we're losing money. You want to come around and tell that man who stayed faithful through the bad times, and then he gets DeAndre Ayton, he's starting to build a roster. And when it's profitable, you want to tell him, he's a bad person for wanting a profit? Like,
I don't think like morale, like I'm not saying people are bad.
Okay.
I'm saying like this is a fact in how our country has grown.
Right.
So even the
why change the name?
Even the I'm not saying we should change the name.
Oh. Okay.
It is what it is. But I'm saying I think that we need to recognize that there is something there that it doesn't necessarily speak to the morality of every owner, but it speaks to the morality of our nation and how we built our nation. I mean, even like you talk about like the idea of entertainment, like how did that become such a big thing in our country? A lot of it was minstrel shows. So this idea of, well, like we're paying them to entertain us at this high level. I mean, we put money into it to make it into that. But I'm not even saying each owner is bad that you feel bad for owning. I'm just saying recognize the history.
Hmm. But is that history tied to every owner?
I think it's tied to the system.
The system of people that own NBA teams currently.
It's always going to be some residue. If you're in America and if you're owning something on a large scale,
right.
If you're a rich white male, there's going to be some residue that you cannot escape from it. Just the racialization of America. Whether you want that title or you want that, you know, outlook to be on you, or if you don't care, you know, people are still going to say, own. Nah, let's change the name. Let's change the name. Because you can own a house, but when you know, people can just, they get caught up with the, what do you mean own? Like, I put up the buckets. Like, you don't own my skills.
So are we talking then that it should be more of a symbiotic relationship?
Yeah.
Like, you need me to play well, but I also need you to pay for the arena, the food, the staff, the training facilities. So it's a trade-off, right? This person's paying for everything that kind of gives you this ecosystem that allows LeBron James to be LeBron James. Because if not, LeBron would have to put up so much money to be able to be where he's at and also worry about playing well. But so maybe it's a symbiotic relationship.
And then
just changing the name help.
Even with putting up the money, I mean, ticket sales do that. I put up the buckets, and these ticket sales just made that new facility. Like, I put up the buckets, these ticket sales just created more jobs.
Yeah.
Cleveland. Like, jobs boomed when LeBron was banging. Now he's out. So it's like,
is it the owner or is it LeBron?
You did.
But I feel like it's a little bit of both, because, like, there's the interface that lets people buy tickets easily and accessibly. Like, if they want to sell them, if they want to use them, if they want to go see LeBron during a game, if LeBron ain't playing, you know, there's that. There's the concessions. There's the whole experience of going to a game.
Uh-huh.
Then there's the marketing of the team. There's the
Cable contracts.
I mean, there's just so much that, like, LeBron is not worried about day in, day out. You know what I'm saying? That's what I'm saying. It's like, we got to understand, though, from... Maybe because I own a business.
Are,
like,
are we arguing to say we should change the name? Because I don't think anybody thinks we should change the name at this table.
My question is, does it make it better? If you're a black athlete and you're in the NBA, do you feel better? Because nothing's changed. That dude still writes your check. Because let's be honest, LeBron's an employee at the end of the day.
I think if you're a black athlete in any sport, or if you're a black entertainer in any discipline, then you should be looking at how to own your own stuff like Jay-Z did.
That's right.
LeBron James is LeBron James has a production company.
Yep.
He makes his own content.
Yeah.
Like, he doesn't have anybody tell him how to make that content. Sure, right. He used basketball to get his name his brand to make it out the hood, but right. What is he doing with it? So I think that a lot of times when we talk about race in the country, we get caught up in petty shit and we're like do Black Lives Matter or do White Lives Matter? And it's like, well, like, this is being used to keep us from looking at the actual thing and what can impact a change.
Right.
So instead of being like, we shouldn't call you owners, like, how about you become an owner?
That's right.
And how about us as black people support the owners? So, like, make sure you get that title subscription.
Mm. Yeah, no, I'm 110% for that. Like, I think that's definitely important. I think teaching African-Americans and, you know, other races in America to stop having these arguments about things that don't really, really matter and really have a more deeper conversation. Like you said, like, ownership. Can we help educate someone about the progression it takes to then invest $300 million into something? Like, starts off small. Like, you have to start that small and then work your way up so that you're ready to be able to handle that kind of investment, because it's not easy, you know?
Meek Mill just became a part owner of Lids.
Yeah, that's crazy.
That's good.
Yeah, I'm not saying
I'm all about black investment, black ownership. Like, I think it's important to, like, for black Americans to create a standard for the culture. Like, I think for a long time, I did not like a lot of the things that black culture was, like, promoting out because it was just, it was, like, contradictory. It's like, we want to say we want A, but then we're arguing about B. And I'm like, wait,
we're a product of that.
We're a product of
what we've been fed.
But is that an excuse?
I don't think it's an excuse, but it's understanding it. So if a child sits down and watches crap on TV all day, he's gonna be a zombie. Like you can't really blame that. And sometimes you need to shine a light on that to show people what that is. You follow? Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah.
Man, that's good. That's good.
Okay, so when we look at that, and we move that towards, like, let's just say, like, I don't know, like, Blexit. What do y'all feel about, like, so as black African-Americans are now focusing on how do we empower each other? How do we invest our dollars back into the culture? What do y'all feel about, like, this new movement of maybe political, I don't even know, like, a political movement to, like, allow African-Americans to vote and really control the power of their vote?
Wait, what? Hold on. What?
What do you mean, like?
Blexit as in black people leaving the Democratic Party?
Well, no, I think Blexit is more about African Americans having the power of their vote truly. Like, not like so you actually are saying, I want this and I won't vote for this person just because they're a part of the Democratic Party.
Yeah, I don't.
So, controlling the power of your vote, empowering each other to start, like, creating a new standard. Like, hey, we want black ownership in the NBA. We want
a whole new league, big three.
Yeah, yeah. Is that black owned?
That's owned by Ice Cube.
Yeah. He said no, but like, is he the only person that owns it?
Well, I would assume there's other people owning it, but he's the face of it. It was his idea.
What I wonder is, in terms of Blexit, maybe give more of the context of what it is, who it's led by, things like that, so we can have, like, a discussion that our viewers would be informed by kind of what we're talking.
Right. Because go ahead, Damon.
No, I was hoping that. All right.
You don't want to read.
So, all right. So, Candace Owens has started a movement. Candace Owens is.
We agreed not to say her name. Yeah, I don't want to give her any. I don't want to give her any. This is free marketing for her.
Yo, my God. Candace Owens is a right. Like,
I take my easy.
Like, hey, this ain't that big a pocket. Somebody already like, I don't support her. Candace Owens is a political I would say she's a political activist, a very, very deep conservative, and she started a movement called Blexit, which is basically to empower African Americans to leave the Democratic Party, right, to vote.
Vote for who?
I would say vote for whoever they think is best. But you could also argue for sure that she's definitely promoting the Republican Party as well.
So they're best?
Can't turn us into Democrat voting mules.
Yeah, it sounds like some propaganda to me.
I mean, so, it is true that African Americans vote as a large block democratically. They vote for the Democratic Party, and they've had deep, deep issues with America for the last 50 years since voting for the Democratic Party.
We had deep, deep issues with America since we've been here. One.
We're talking about the focus on, like, since it was a vote, like, you could literally see a large swath. Instead of it being parity, like, some would vote, a large amount of African Americans used to vote Republican back in the 50s, 40s, 30s.
Yeah, but that was for the Southern deal.
No, but I'm saying there used to be more parity with voting. Now, since the 60s, it has been 95. I don't think I'm wrong with that.
Yeah,
it's
been
like 95% one party. Yeah. But then it's like, hey, we have issues with America in these ways, but we continue to vote with one party. So I feel like the conversation hasn't been had between the Democratic Party and African Americans. Because if you're voting 95%, the conversation needs to be had between you and the party you've been voting for, what you want. And I think it's okay for her to have this movement to say, hey, you should stop voting for them and demand that you get promotion of whatever your issues.
I'm cool with that if it comes from somebody who's, like, actually standing on, like, if it comes from somebody without an agenda. So, like, Malcolm X talks about the...
Who doesn't have an agenda, though?
Malcolm X talks about the wolf and the fox. And he says the wolf will come to you with his fangs out, talking about how Republicans were racist. Then he said the fox will come to you and try to lure you in. talking about how Democrats are racist. I think throughout history, there's been a lot of black leaders who have talked out against both parties. Mm. But I have a problem with somebody who kind of rides Trump's wave and is like, y'all need to stop voting black because it's like they're trying to make it this new black thing. And it's like, nah, you're just trying to get us to vote Republican when like that they ain't really rocking with us either.
Right.
I think the trouble, I think, comes when you create a false equivalency between the two groups. And so I don't think anyone would ever argue that the Democratic Party or liberals in general, progressives in general, are perfect. And you can look at the Birmingham letter from Birmingham, Dr. Martin Luther King, where he talks about white moderates and white liberals. And you can see that throughout African-American history, there have been criticisms and critiques of, you know, progressives and liberals and the Democratic Party. Even, like, if you look at Cornel West, during Barack Obama's presidency, you'll see that he had like a lot of sharp, pointed criticisms of Barack Obama. You know, even Ta-Nehisi Coates, in his review of Barack Obama, wrote good things, but he had some pretty harsh, scathing criticisms of Barack Obama as well. And so it's not to say that there are not criticisms that we can make of the Democratic Party, but I think like when you create a false equivalency between the Democratic Party and the Republican Party that's trying to do everything they can to gerrymander, to kind of like suppress our votes.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, it's like you're creating an equivalency between two groups that are not equal and don't treat us the same way. So even though I would agree 100%, you know, there's racism within the Democratic Party. I think that our voices have been ignored for too long. There are several, I actually found more insight after reviewing like the gubernatorial elections, I think is how you say it, or the governor's elections during the midterms, rather than the actual presidential or national elections, which is when you kind of got to see how African-American people, I suppose you could say, galvanized around people like Andrew Gillum and Stacey Abrams, in these southern states that have historically always been held by Republicans. And I think that's another big thing. It's like, if you want me to go to the Republican Party, then I need the Republican Party to represent my views and interests.
What have you done for me lately?
Exactly. So it's like,
my
thing is like, if you want me to go to the Republican Party, I need to see more. I need to see you as a party run more people who look like me, who think like me. Because here's the truth about African American people that I think a lot of people don't address is that African American people are a lot more conservative than what we see normally represented in the media in terms of our moral views. Like if you go into your average African-American community and you take a survey of the people, you'll see that our views are a lot more conservative than what might be led on or might be portrayed by our voting outcome. And so I don't think it's necessarily the idea that Republican people are morally conservative that's repulsive, but I think we've been trained over time to recognize pointed dog whistle tactics. So we've been trained over time to recognize when someone is like opposed to busing, what that really means, right? When we talk about like
and the history of where that comes from.
History of where busing comes from, or when someone talks about certain things, even Candace Owens, she's really like Candace Owens and other people, you know, Tommy Lauren, people of that ilk are very talented with the way that they use their phrases in an attempt to not be expressly racist or explicitly racist. But like we're trained, I believe African Americans are, in a lot of ways, to pick up on subtle and even subconscious uses of certain words, phrases, and policies. And we know how they impact us. So when Jeff Sessions comes out, when Donald Trump was running the first time, he starts talking about stop and search.
Stop and frisk.
Stop and frisk. Like, I know what stop and frisk means for me and people in my community. Even if people who don't live in my community or live around people who look like me don't understand what stop and frisk means, I know when he says we should bring back stop and frisk, I know what he means.
And law and order.
Exactly. In law and order. Terms like
law and order politics.
Law and order, exactly. We start using terms like thugs and criminals, and we hear those terms and we maybe process them a different way because of our shared history.
Sound like Ronald Reagan.
Right. Oh. So,
shit, yeah. It sounds like Woodrow Wilson. Shit, right. We can go further back than that, bro.
Right. Or it sounds like the Southern Strategy.
Birth of a Nation.
Right, because when we talk about think about the Southern Strategy, it was an attempt by white people to use dog whistle tactics because they knew they couldn't be racist and outwardly anymore. So they had to use subtle, quiet, tactics to pander to people.
To take from one group, the Southern Democrats, and bring them into the Republicans.
Bring them into another group. And so, like,
to try to win elections.
So here's my thing about Candace Owens and Blexit. Here's the thing that we have to understand. I think that what they profit off of is ignorance of the black community. Because you cannot argue that African-American people are less politically apt than other communities, right? But here's what I would say. Conservatives have always existed in the black community.
Yeah.
The conservative ways of thinking have always existed in the African-American community.
Yeah.
So, like, the idea that suddenly we need to have a mass exodus from the Democratic Party to service our conservative, I think that's not the point.
They
start from the premise of, and here's the thing, this is what I would argue. I would say that Candace Owens, Blexit, and people who kind of associate with her in that same realm, they start from the premise of African American people being less intelligent in terms of their voting record. And like, if you look at historically, every group, not just African American people, but every group that has fought for the franchise has had to deal with those exact same stereotypes. The idea that these individuals they're easily manipulated. You know what I'm saying? In other words, they can't be trusted with the vote. That goes back to what my grandparents fought against. Like when you would go into the voting booth because we were granted the right to vote, but we did not have protections for voting until the Civil Rights Act.
But we were voting for a little bit, and
right.
then they started saying, can you really let these guys vote?
Exactly.
They came out with the film. They influenced it through the entertainment about black people eating chicken in Congress and raping white women. And now this was the father of film, the biggest motion picture of the time.
Right.
And so what they did was they started to enact literacy tests, right? So when you came to vote, you had to prove that you could read. Or you had to take like tests that had nothing to do with like voting. Like you had to name every individual in the, you know,
city government.
Local city government. And they started enacting these things to show that African Americans were less literate with their votes. But like the thing is, and this is why I say that classism is the father of racism. Because like if you look at every group, because we have to remember that when America was first founded, not every white man could vote.
True.
That's very true.
So only rich landowning.
That's the loudest I heard you all day, Obey. I'm joking.
I'm just trying to listen. I'm just
could vote. Andrew Jackson was actually the individual who extended the franchise to all white men. I mean, he was still a racist.
he was holding it down for the white people.
Right,
gotcha.
Exactly.
Right.
He at least extended the vote to more people.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that the criticisms that are being put upon African American people, you all vote in blocks. Well, other groups vote in blocks as well. 85% of white evangelicals voted for Donald Trump.
Right.
Who's pointing fingers?
Right.
Like, I mean, 55% of white women voted for Donald Trump. That's a large block of people.
Right. So do we here have an issue with large, you know,
blocks.
Homogenous blocks of people voting one way or another?
I think...
Do you feel like it should be more parity?
I think that if we have more options, it'll be more spread out.
Right.
But I think it's much easier for one candidate to say, I'm going to get the evangelical vote, I'm going to get the black vote,
right.
I'm going to get the woman vote,
right.
from trying to pander to
certain
things.
Politics, I think, is mostly pander perception.
Yeah.
I think it's
But if we have more options,
right.
There's more than one.
But I don't know if I want to be necessarily like Europe.
There's no mic here.
No, you're good. You're good.
I don't even know if more options is the answer.
Right, because, you know, in France, you can win the presidency with 27% of the vote. I don't know if I necessarily want a president where we all be like, man, I mean, he won his 30% of the vote.
My bad.
I don't know if more options is the answer. I think in democracy we should expect things to be clumsy, is what I think. And so like I think as fellow participants in the democracy, I feel like we should respect one another's right to choose. As crazy as that sounds, like just because someone disagrees with you doesn't mean it's going to be the end of the democracy.
Amen.
If that makes any
sense. Amen. Amen.
You know, like, so I feel like I'm not sure if more options is the, because like it didn't help. With the actual Brexit, which is where she stole that term from, she's not creative.
She's not. I can understand someone saying, listen, like, is it the best for African Americans to, in one hand, vote completely the same way,
yeah.
and the other hand,
continue to ask questions about America without asking questions to the people they're voting for.
So I don't think we're asking questions to the people we're voting for?
No, I just don't
think... You saw Joe Biden... Stop. you saw Joe Biden get roasted at the debates, right?
No. That actually brings up the Democratic debates. I'm just saying what I've seen politically since, like, I've been keeping really deep track, probably since, like, 2015, is that African Americans are asking questions about America... But I did not see it for 8 years of Barack Obama or on a wide scale.
Hold on. Trayvon Martin didn't happen under Barack Obama?
It did.
Trayvon Martin had...
Who was asking questions about America then?
They're asking questions about America, but not about what is Barack going to do to help Trayvon Martin not happen again. Where was the question towards the senator, the governor, the state? Like, there were questions to political people in power during those situations. It was more a question to... What is America going to do about these black children and their bodies? What is America going to do about racism? What is America... Those are all great questions. What I'm saying is, when is African Americans started to say... Like, you know, just like... I'm not saying on a mass scale. I'm saying we're very intelligent blocks of them saying, hey, we have an issue with this person in the party. But go ahead.
But, like, look at... I'm sorry, but, like, look at Cornel West, who I already mentioned.
Yeah, Cornel West.
Ta-Nehisi Coates,
what was his critique? Like refresh, like
I mean,
he,
like
wrote, this, he wrote a whole essay.
Yeah, he wrote an entire essay
about the Obama years. Didn't he?
Yeah, he did.
Yeah, it was like
and in the whole essay. Years. And like I said, he had a lot of praises.
Right. I've wanted to read some of his books. Well. I've read a couple articles of his. Yeah. One about
Michael Eric Dyson.
Oh, I love Michael.
I mean, like, he criticized the president as well.
A lot of people criticized Obama. Michael, a lot of black people criticized Barack
Obama. People that
Michael Eric Dyson called Barack Obama Pharaoh. Like, just... like...
It's right, not, right, like, right. I'm not saying that people did not criticize. I'm not trying to overgeneralize. I'm saying we did not see, like, mass protests and movements to be like...
Yes, we did, though.
This person must... No, again, America as a whole. We're talking about this governor is like... Baltimore was black from the literal local city council all the way to the governor. I'm saying, where was the "you have let us down"? We voted for you. This happened on your watch. You have let us down.
I think that's
why. Why aren't we having those? I think those are more constructive because we've forgotten that politics is local to national.
I think it's very nitpicky to talk about how people deal with their pain,
right?
Because the pain of what happened in Baltimore wasn't a political thing. This was literally people lashing out in pain.
Yeah.
So when we dissect it and we go under a microscope and we say, well why didn't you criticize the black governor? Right. That sounds like a lot of conservative rhetoric where they really try to make it about race when really it's something not bigger than race, but it's bigger than who is, if it's a black governor or white governor.
I can understand African Americans.
I'm sorry to tack on to what he's saying.
Yeah.
It's like you have to also dissect, like, who is feeding you the news.
Right.
So even like CNN, for example.
Right.
Does CNN, do they have a vested interest in Barack Obama remaining president? Yes. So will they report that any African Americans are criticizing Barack Obama? No. Like, they don't have a, what I'm saying is, They don't have a vested interest.
And Fox News isn't broadcasting Michael Eric Dyson or Cornel West.
Right. Right.
So anyway, right. So you're not going to hear it on those shows.
They have other black correspondents.
And also,
I mean, Cornel West has been on Fox News, but they're not trying to get him every time.
Right. And here's the thing.
And I'm not promoting, like, all I'm asking is just questions of, like, I can understand the black pain after these deaths, right?
Sure.
I can understand the questions. I'm constantly trying to read and read and read and read as much as I can and follow these things. All I'm saying is, for the African American people that want to see certain changes, I'm just worried about this focus on the federal and not on the local people that actually have an influence on your day to day.
I understand what you're saying, but
you know.
So for my internship, I went to the Congressional Black Caucus this year to interview somebody.
Right.
And they were really talking about, what are Democrats going to do for us? So I think a lot of times, like, you don't know what you don't know. And I think if you're looking at the news through the Candace Owens lens of Blexit, then you're getting a part of the story and not the full story. Because I think that there are a lot of black liberal politicians or black politicians who run under a liberal or under a Democratic sticker who have a lot of critiques against the Democratic Party. There's a ton of them. I've heard them speak out against these.
Against I always feel like politics behind closed doors is the real. I wish we could just see those real people. Yeah. Because like when you watch the Democratic debates, it is to me just a show.
It's bullshit.
And the same thing with the Republican debates and Republican races. It's just politics is perception. How can I be perceived like I care? And then how can I pander enough? How can I offer enough so you feel like I care so I can get your votes? And that just is sad to me because what African Americans really truly desire can be achieved in America today. I think
to put us all under one umbrella, of what we desire, that makes us one story, that makes us, that kind of puts us into like a stereotype. Mm-hmm. I think that we all desire many different things, but I think that, like I said earlier, if you want something, go out and get it and support people who are getting it like you. So make sure y'all download Tidal.
Is that the fourth plus?
Does Jay-Z have you on the payroll?
I'm getting him to do
it. I'm trying to get on it, bro.
He's like, yo, Jay-Z, hit a brother up.
I think Jay-Z will be fine. I'm pretty sure
Jay-Z's made enough money.
Didn't he just reach a billion?
Make sure, a billion? Make sure y'all listen. Make sure y'all listen to Story Mode on Tidal then.
That's right. Okay, so then, I just want to wrap up like our conversation with that. And like, again, this... I think we started with like ownership and then how African Americans and the NBA feel about the word, you know, owner and the way that they're perceived by ownership, and then into how African Americans right now just voting and like some of the movements within the community. What do y'all feel about the Democratic debates? Did y'all watch it? Did y'all feel like you found a candidate that you liked?
I thought it was dope.
I thought it was dope? Yeah. Both nights or just one night?
I thought both nights were great. A lot of people were speaking to things that I value. Whether it's education.
Like who's hitting show in the heart?
It was so much overlap, Obey.
Really?
It was overlap. I can't even say because people were stealing Bernie's platform.
Yeah.
I'm not gonna lie.
Yo, also real, I feel like Bernie is getting like, wait, you're saying it like it'd be like the rich
and then
Tudor's looking down and be like, wait, what do you mean? What I've actually done to fight the rich. It's like it is kind of funny how like his platform was radical like just 4 years ago, and now it's like eight people being like,
wait a second.
Like, raise your hand if you offer free college.
Yeah.
Everybody's trying to get the younger generation. That's what it is. Because Bernie got the younger generation. They're trying to tack onto those younger voters.
So can Bernie win?
Don't listen to the polls. That's all I'll say. Do not listen to the polls. The polls don't matter.
When did you lose hope in the polls?
2016.
Me too.
It's gone.
Yeah, I think in order for any candidate to win, I think they have to make a realistic way to free middle Americans from their economic status at this time. And I think that's what Donald Trump promised. Mm-hmm. Like if you listen to his like some of his earlier speeches, they're hard to get through. But if you listen to him, a lot of the things that he says in terms of like, we're gonna bring back this, we're gonna bring back that. Democrats kick this out, mm-hmm. we're gonna bring back that. And I think like if you listen to Hillary's, what Hillary was saying was true. Like, there's no way, due to globalization and the revolution of technology, there's no way that we're bringing back some of these jobs. What we need for you to do is get an education. And with your education, you can get better jobs and new jobs, right? So, but I think that didn't tickle the ear of middle America. And I think, like, ultimately, I think people in America, I think, expect a certain economic, like, we expect the line to go up. In other words, you know what I mean? So I think whoever's going to run, if you want to beat Trump, I think you have to steal some of those Rust Belt states that he stole from Barack Obama's, you know, previous candidacy. I think you have to steal some of those states back. And I think the way that you do that, in my opinion, my humble opinion, I think the way that you do that is by making those making promises and putting real actionable plans in place to help those middle Americans. That's what I would say.
Like building a wall.
You crazy. No. I think bipartisanship is one way you can, you know, go against
Trump. That's not possible. That's not possible.
Republicans who go against Trump, you got Democrats who go against Trump. They have one thing in common. We don't like Trump. Like you can go across the aisle.
I don't think we all want the same thing. I don't think we'll see bills like we did in the 90s and the early 2000s where it was like
the body camera on a policeman, that was a bipartisan bill. things like that.
But that could be handled locally. Like your local government can just make that. Like there's too many things federally where I'm like, yeah, it's great that they did that, but that's again pandering because literally each state could have just handled that themselves. The federal government should be focusing on larger things than just body cameras on cops, because I feel like that's a small thing that can already be handled through city council can make that happen. Mm-hmm. Your local state government can make that happen.
And what I'm saying is the answer to the question was, right. How can we not see another Trump presidency? My answer is bipartisanship. When you have a Democrat candidate and you have a Republican candidate going head to head, how can you defeat Trump? Only if you talk to his party, people who follow him, to say, you know what? I agree with other conservatives feel on this issue. Trump, he's out there with it. But with you guys, I can see and I can value your different issues, you know, and I want to work with you. Actually, you can see my history that I have bipartisan bills. So to my answer would be to check out Vance Jones' book, The Messy Truth, where he talks about coming across the aisle. It goes back to what Damani was saying, how, you know, when it comes to conservatism, like black people, like that's what we were, you know, or that's what we are. So that's how I feel.
So who do you feel can speak to Trump's base and draw them in? Who did you see at the Democratic debates?
Unfortunately, Joe Biden. Unfortunately.
Oh, you don't like Joe Biden?
He's hard to like.
I can see Yang. Andrew Yang.
The UBI?
Everybody gets a check?
I'm not saying that's going to happen.
Okay, but you
say, who can reach his base?
I do think Andrew Yang has done a good job of trying to space.
We're not left, we're not right, we're right. Forward.
And I think when I've listened to him in two long-form podcasts, he is believable enough to a conservative base to draw them in. But again, he's just not fiscally strong enough, I think, to draw certain Republicans in. But definitely if you're like in West Virginia, mm-hmm. and this guy's saying, I'm going to give you $15,000 as your floor to help you with automation, I could definitely see that drawing into Trump's base. I could definitely see that for sure.
Yep. It's not going to happen. But
yeah, he's not going to win. Yeah.
But I mean, if just to throw out a name, you know, I could see him. He doesn't pander to certain things. Like I don't hear those dog whistles when I listen to Andrew Yang. I remember it was the Breakfast Club interview and Charlamagne asked Bernie straight up, so what you doing with these reparations? Bernie was like,
I don't really know.
That's not what we are going to be focusing on right now.
which is a legitimate question.
What's up with these reparations? Shamari's Bernie impression every like every couple of days.
What do you want? I'm from Brooklyn.
Yeah. Rich. I just like the dude. Just like I love Bernie, man. That dude just kills me.
I'm gonna be talking louder.
Not. I think I like
what Bernie. Louder than me.
I think I like what Bernie represents. Like it to some people. I think I don't like his policies, but I think he's just funny to me. I mean, I wouldn't vote for him. I just think he's just like truly.
What don't you like about his policies?
I don't think that they can pan out like fiscally.
What do you mean?
Go ahead, Sean.
I think we all like these policies because we like ideals. We like ideas. We like them, but we don't necessarily agree with how they would pan out. So I would say we don't agree,
right?
Like practically.
I don't think a lot of people have really sat down and realized how quickly expenses and things that cost. You think a lot now can scale to unbelievable amounts, and that we already are in debt. We already have a certain amount of money that we can maybe make some things work, but I don't think that we can provide legitimately in 1 year of a presidency, free school all the way through, free healthcare all the way through, free childcare. Like all these things are going to cost a lot.
We can.
And the businesses
we can.
That
we can't. It just depends where my taxes are going.
No, well,
or who's getting taxed.
Do you want
taxed?
Your taxes to increase?
Or who's getting taxed?
I don't think that it's even that. I think if you look at Dr. King's life and legacy, and he started to break down toward the end of his life, an understanding of what I would say would be the three evils, and one of those evils was militarism.
Yes.
And I would say that like militarism in America. We don't recognize it, but it sucks up so much of our capital. So we think we don't have money,
that we have.
It goes to the military.
Right.
and the police now, too.
So. Exactly, exactly. So, like, the money goes into the federal government to, I mean, like, in the things that we're spending money on to pay private prisons. You see what I'm saying? Like, we, because
tanks,
of the...
Like, what police force does it take?
Right. And so, like, the militarized, like, the hyper-militarized state sucks up money. And Martin Luther King would say that every bomb that drops in Vietnam is felt hardest in the ghetto.
And how many wars we have right now?
Right. And so I think that like not just overseas, but also domestically, like that hyper-militarization, the wall, like the federal funding that gets spent to keep people, to hire investigators, to find people who are doing drugs, to incarcerate them for lifetimes, for drug offenses because it's their third time selling drugs.
That's legal in a different state.
In a different state.
And
like,
people are making money off
that's
it.
Right.
That's strategic.
Exactly.
Racism,
those things cost money. And I'm saying, like, I think what he started to realize toward the end of his life is that, like, what America needs is a revolution of our values.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And through a revolution of our values, we would begin to see that the things that we think are not as important are important. So if we really, truly value our nation's poor, people like children who can't get 3 square meals a day, if we really value, I would say canceling college debt is probably a better idea than making college free, because I think when Bernie says that, I'm not sure if he's recognizing that I don't think college is the answer to our economic woes.
Yeah.
I think college is a scam. I mean,
I 100% agree with that. 100%.
For some, yeah, college is a scam.
I think college is a scam in that not that it doesn't help some. It's just that we have created a system where people that are working certain degrees that need college are subsidized by a vast majority of people that don't need college but are told they need college.
Right.
Like, hey, you should go get creative writing and spend $40,000 a year to study creative writing.
Or underwater
while
basket
someone,
weaving.
While someone's doing spending engineering, going to study engineering, is spending the same as you.
I think the reason I say college is a scam is because I think over time, I think classism evolves in such a way, and I'm not a socialist, but I think what we can recognize...
Not anymore.
I was like...
I think what we should recognize is that over time, classism consistently develops lines, right? So we tell people... We keep pushing the line forward. We keep telling people, in order to be successful, you need this. And then when everyone has that, high school diploma, in order to be successful, you need this. Now that we've been taught this for so long, and we all believe that America's a meritocracy, we've been taught for so long that you need a college degree to be successful, and now we're getting at a point where people who have college degrees now are making less than people who had high school degrees 10, 15 years ago. And you were at a point now where you will make, statistically, you are more likely to earn less than your parents earned. And this is the first time that's happened since, like, the Second World War.
I remember reading an article about
right.
that.
Right, and so, like...
Yeah, that
and
was...
And so, because of that fact, I think people all believe that they need a college degree. I'm not saying that college or education itself is a scam, but I'm saying the belief that everyone needs a college degree to be successful is the scam, right? Because, I get paid from college.
Right.
So, you know, actually, I can't say, you know. Don't worry about it.
So Bernie's offerings are, he's offering all these free things.
Yeah.
When he is asked how he pays for it, he makes up his arbitrary, like, tax. Yeah, I really do think so. I think he has not shown you, listed out, okay, here's the math on how I will tax Wall Street. Here's what that will equal, plus interest over 25 years. And here's what I'm going to call
it. I have five words for America. Mexico will pay for it.
Exactly.
Those are five
words. Who lays out their whole economic plan when running for president? Like, who's done that?
No, I get that.
What are you expecting?
I guess my point is you're criticizing him because he wants to offer, not you. I know that you're playing devil's advocate. You, general, is criticizing Bernie Sanders because he wants to offer free education, free, you know, healthcare, free all these benefits that will help people where they are. But you fail to criticize the man who is going to build an invisible, he said invisible wall on the Mexican border and said Mexico will pay for it.
Listen,
where's the criticism of that?
Listen.
Maybe Bernie should make his argument more simple.
If we want to get into 30 minutes of crazy things Trump has said, bad things Trump has done, I think there has been plenty of conversation about that.
And I get sick of talking about it.
Right. What I want to focus on is, again, we're focused on the African American community, yeah. focus on the Democratic debate. We're focused on somebody who could actually win the presidency. And we're focused on something that's, I think, truly a fundamental shift. Think about it. Like, we are a capitalist country that uses the benefits of capitalism for socialized programs, sure. right? So if we start to fundamentally shift to where we are just now funneling a lot of capital into these free things that are insurmountable expenses. I mean, you cannot do a math equation that can tell you exactly what you will spend in healthcare in a year. It is very hard. That's why you see other countries that struggle to keep their nationalized health systems afloat. They need to do it with between 20 countries like the EU. And once two or three countries back out, it's not profitable for all the other countries to be able to do it. It's a hard thing to do. Yeah. So what I'm saying is when African Americans who watch the Democratic debate like Shomari did or you did and I did and Chad did, when you're watching this and this man's saying free, all I'm saying is at some point, I just wish he would get someone to just show me how, because it's a hard thing to say. All of those will be free within 4 years.
I think it's aspirational. Fair share.
And I understand your point. I understand your point with militarism. I think militarism is a huge issue with America. I don't think we need to be the world's police. I don't think we need a base in every country. You know, as an immigrant, and I talked to a lot of friends who are immigrants, their perception of America is vastly different than what Americans think of themselves. And when they see a base from America in their country, but they can't have a base in your country, they're like, then is this a friendship? Is this, you know, like, you get to come over to my house, you can eat my food, but I gotta ask and text you before I can come over. Like, what kind of relationship is that? So I can understand where our vast overreaching military could be honed in, and we can still keep national security and still protect the U.S. because that's one of the big major things the federal government is supposed to do, is to keep us safe. So I understand having that baseline that we can still do that and not be isolationist. But I don't think that the money that we will save from that will pay for half of what he's asking.
It's a collective of things, though. It's your fair share. If you are an oil company and if you are toxifying Louisiana and you are polluting their air, you're putting toxins into their water,
right?
And they're not getting any kind of, you know, benefits in their livelihood from that. And you continue to capitalize on their, to their detriment. That's an issue. When you're Amazon, and I continuously buy things from you and you pay nothing in taxes, then are you doing your fair share? It's multiple things, and it's always to people who are doing billions, millions, or above 500,000 a year, or it's some number that they put it to that you're going to be at this tax bracket where you're going to pay that as far as your fair share. And where does that go? That goes to the less fortunate. And just seeing it with the biblical worldview, that's where my vote lies, the less fortunate. How do we help the less fortunate? Because we can take the route of meritocracy. Well, I pulled myself up by my bootstrap and I am where I am. So why can't you? Well, what if they don't have boots? You know, that's where it comes down to. What if they ain't got feet?
What if you took their boots?
What if you took their boots? So meritocracy, work yourself up. That is, I would say it's an easy argument, and it's disingenuous to the history of America when people got a leg up on the back of people.
That's free labor. We built on free labor.
And
right?
And when it comes who gets something for free,
right.
Who got it first? Right. Who got affirmative action first?
But name a country where you saw no classism. Name a country where you saw no racism.
I think
that's my issue. Is like when we have this conversation America.
We had the issue with
past America, right? And we look at the history of America. I see nothing in Sweden's history, Germany's history, France, most of the countries in Africa. When you start to really read up on these countries, it's not like they were sitting here in these perfect utopian societies where a woman had a right to choose and you could vote. And hey, if you wanted to own land, you could just build that business up. And, you know, M'Baku started a lemonade stand and worked his way up to being a millionaire in Nigeria.
He can say M'Baku because he's African. Everybody is
not.
Don't go home and call somebody Mbappe and get your ass whooped.
Right? No, but I'm just saying, like when we look at America's history, I'm like, I get you what you're saying, Show, but it's like, I think we have this false perception that, like, there was a country that preached this. So, like,
at the end of the day, it's all about money. Who is the world's superpower right now?
America,
right? How do we make our money? How do we become that superpower?
Capitalism. Free market capitalism.
How did America start turning a profit?
Industrial Revolution.
Before Industrial Revolution.
Exactly.
We fought a whole war on how we was going to keep making this money. You feel what I'm saying?
Oh, with slavery. Right.
Yeah. Like, this is at the foundation of how we built our
but
way to
But slavery
is
at the foundation of almost every nation.
But okay, wait.
Every nation.
I think that, but what I'm saying is, when it comes to America, how we fix America, the same way you was talking about how black people fix black people.
Right.
Like, when it comes to America, how we fix America, we need to focus on how we built our foundation of wealth. And it wasn't just slavery. It was also Jim Crow.
Right.
And it wasn't just against black people. It was also against immigrants and against women.
Right.
So it's not just that other countries did it too. It's that we are trying to be this world leader. We are trying to be in the forefront, and we made our way to the forefront off the backs of other people.
Right.
Yeah, and I would also say
continuously off the backs as we speak right now, because
still
jails.
There should not be a for-profit prison in America. Period.
But I would also argue, though, to tack on to what Chad was saying and what Shamari echoed as well, I would also argue that just because, like, if I was to go to my mom and say, you know, everybody else is doing it, you know, she would say, if everyone else jumping off a cliff, would you go around the cliff too? And I think, like, the idea that we cannot criticize America, I know that's not what you're saying, but I'm taking your argument to its natural conclusion.
Right.
To make a point, if we were to say we cannot criticize America because she's not alone in her sins or her troubles, I don't think that absolves America of its criticisms. I think, as James Baldwin would say, I love America, which is why I reserve the right to criticize it.
Right.
I think, like, criticizing America is intended by most Americans, I would say, to make America better. Even criticizing America is not reserved for one group of people or one party. Everyone criticizes America, which is why I just don't want it to ever get to
a place where we criticize and we act as if America is unique in the criticisms or America is unique in its sins.
I think I'm not sure if America is unique in its sins. Of course, there's been no sin except which is common to man, of course.
Right.
But I would say, I wouldn't say America is unique in its sins, but what I would say is America is unique in its wealth and power.
They were uniquely successful in doing those sins.
Right.
Sweden doesn't have lands and lands of plantation, and they didn't push out all these natives to get all that land.
Yeah, no, but I'm saying, when you look at Sweden, like, what is their history? What have they done? What are their sins?
But I think
they're also in part of Europe. Europe was a country that's way more developed than what America was. America was owned by Native Americans until the Spaniards got here. Then the Spaniards start. You know, it's like,
I understand, but
Sweden was already an established country centuries before us.
I understand what you're saying,
us.
But I don't think that you can. See, that's why I think that the prophetic voice is important in any country or society. And I think, like, even going back to scripture, like, you're looking at if you can consider the children of Israel to be God's chosen people at the time. And you would argue that this must be, in all of humanity, at the time at least, this is where God resides. This must be the best country on earth. But they didn't stop Isaiah, didn't stop Jeremiah, didn't stop the Amos, didn't stop Micah, didn't stop all the major and minor prophets from ripping their ass to shreds. Okay? Like just because you live in a good country or a better country shouldn't stop the prophetic voice from speaking. Shouldn't stop you from, cuz we're not comparing America to other countries. We're comparing America to sacred text. We're comparing America to the kingdom of heaven. We're saying you've fallen short. Repent. And we're saying, make it right. We're talking about restorative justice. We're saying, you took his mule, David. Like, if a rich man has, you know, a rich man has all these mules and he kills this guy to get a mule. Like, I mean, like Nathan said to David, like, what do you think should happen, David?
Yeah.
What do you think should happen?
Yeah.
David's like, well, man, if it was me, God, you know, I'm unsheathing the sword, God. You know what I'm saying? I'm going to go out there and chop this nigga head, God.
Right,
you know what I'm saying?
Right.
And like the truth is that in that illustration, I would say that's America. You know what I'm saying? I would say, and it's time that we, like, not time that we, because we've always been, African-American people, in my opinion, have been America's prophetic voice and keeper. What I'm saying is, you can't detract from America's criticisms because she's, by comparing her to other countries or comparing her to other nations and saying, no, we're here. I'm in America.
Right.
So I mean, even though like a poor person in America is like a king in
80% of the country.
Some 80% of the world.
Right.
They're, it doesn't
poverty result. Here is not really poverty.
I wouldn't say that either.
But, no. I mean, like in comparison to other countries.
Yeah, just
like if you were to put poverty here versus everyone else, you'd be in the middle class of most of the countries in the world. That's what I'm saying. Is that really poverty?
Cost of living.
That's called perception. You think it's poverty because you're looking at riches and middle class and wealth. So you feel like you're impoverished. But I would never say
that to a homeless person, but I understand what you're saying.
No. If you want to say that, go ahead.
I wouldn't say that.
That person is not removed from feeling the way they feel.
Sure.
It's just that this country is so great that to be like, and again, and a homeless person, I would not consider poverty. That person's like, you know, in dire poverty. That person's like, but I'm talking about somebody who's considered impoverished by the government. That person, you know, who makes around $20,000, $30,000, lives, you know, with two kids, like, you know, has a car, has a cell, like that person is not truly to the extent of what they really believe is dire poverty comparative. They're more blessed than what they think.
I was just teasing you, but I know you're playing devil's advocate, but I guess my point is we shouldn't shrink back from criticizing.
We should criticize America. We should seek to make America a better place. I think you guys have pushed me. I've read books to open my perspective to what America can be. But I also think that, like, as an immigrant to this country, coming from an immigrant family, I also see a lot of great things about America that I think that, like, if you live somewhere else and came here, you'd be... And that's why I think you see a lot of immigrants, they come here and they're just focused on succeeding and they're going forth. And I understand there are groups of people like Black Americans here that need that support. And that's why, like I've always said, I'm with burning the candle at both ends. Let's help the Black community. Let's support them in these services. But also the Black community begins to address certain things within their community that they can begin to see for themselves. So they can, the candle
Let's
can
talk burn about that. What do you see? What would you say those certain things would be?
That would be for the Black community to talk about. I mean, I'm from the outside looking in. I'm coming from Nigeria. I'm coming from a family where I was, when I got here, I have never in my life sat here and been like worried about what a white person is going to do to me. I have from day one since I've gotten here, my parents are just focused on me believing in myself, building skills, gaining skills, finding my path, finding my purpose, and moving forward. So everything that I built for myself, my DJ business, this podcast, anything, has been coming from just the work ethic I've seen in my own father and in my family's history, in my family's story. Mm-hmm. So I just, though things have happened to me that have been wrongful, you know, racist, disrespectful, for sure, without a doubt, there have been things that I have seen from people of other races. But I just do not have time, with the limited time God's given me on this earth to breathe, to be worried about, oh my gosh, what is the oppressive thing that's hindering me back? I'm just trusting the Lord and moving forward.
Yeah, but sometimes it's not about you. Sometimes it's about the people that come after you.
Yeah.
But who's that? What does that mean for the people that come after you?
The generation that comes after you. So I'm worried about the school to prison pipeline. I'm worried about the way that Black kids get criminalized and the way that they're thrown away, and the way that we address behavioral issues with criminal charges. You feel what I'm saying?
I mean, I'm for that too. I don't understand where I wasn't for that and what I said.
My bad. If I misunderstood.
Because he was asking me...
What are some things? Yeah.
Yeah, I was just stating that, like, my personal journey...
You said you don't have time to be worried about how people view you.
I didn't say I wasn't worried about the future generation. I mean, this is part of the reason I started this podcast. Is like, we need to have more conversations. We need younger generation to listen and hear from different perspectives. Podcasting is so amazing because no one can control it. You have the freedom to broadcast and build a brand and share ideas and bring people into focus that maybe some African-American kid here in Lynchburg, Virginia could listen to this podcast and hear from someone that I have on this podcast and be inspired or be encouraged or hear of a program that they never heard about. Mm-hmm. So I hope to have many, many, many voices on this podcast where they can listen in. So my vision for the generation after me
we haven't even gotten to that. I mean, that's a whole different conversation than what my personal experience has been as a, and what I see as like when I what Damani was really touching on is what do I feel the African American community. Sorry, your question. What
do you think? I asked you, what do you think that they need to, I guess, to fix within their own
community? Right. What do they need to start addressing within their own communities? And I said, for me, here's been my journey. And I said, I don't. That's for them to discuss. Gotcha. I just watch from afar because I came in and I've had my own unique experience with the Black community, yeah. And I had my own unique like perceptions of what the Black community was going to be, and it wasn't what I thought it was going to be. And so I've been learning about the Black community because, again, I go home. I'm African. I'm from Nigeria.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't grow up watching certain movies. I watched them after. I love hip hop. I love rap. But I also am a big soccer fan. I have things about me that are very outside of the U.S.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like when I listen to the Black community, I'm like, when I see a African American boy get shot, I didn't grow up in those neighborhoods. So I'm sad.
Yeah. And I think that's,
but I'm not like, it doesn't hit me to this deep core because I'm like, there are people that die every day that, you know, there are genocides going on in Yemen and around the world. What happens in Nigeria, I read up on that, and those things affect me because it's like, those are my people too as well.
Yes.
And it's a deep-rooted thing for me. So it's like, you know, I'm more of a global-minded person because I come from outside the U.S., but also I've been here long enough. You know, I came here when I was like 4 and a half, but I've grown up in a home where inside the home, I'm a Nigerian boy in an American context. Outside, I'm seen as a Black American in the context of a Black American. Yeah. But I never, for me, was able to really truly experience what you guys have experienced. So I'm always learning. Jamani's giving me books to read. I have a bunch of books on my list that I'm reading. And I'm always open to more perspective. All I was saying is, I don't necessarily see, from my limited subjective perspective, I'm not trying to overgeneralize, the African American community just pumping. I don't see loud voices for these things. But I definitely do see them for, you know, these things like criminal justice reform, and I'm all for that.
Yeah,
you know,
what's this?
What is the other things? That's what I was asking. Like, what are those things that you would say?
Like, I would probably say one of the big things is a restorative focus on the family and like as we bring back these fathers, let's build healthier relationships between Black women and Black men or Black fathers, and let's build a more healthier, I think, you know, Black manhood, whatever that looks like for the Black community. So, like, a focus on the restorative family, I think, would be a big thing that I'd love to see more conversation about, because I think that two incomes, one home, under with you know, how many kids are in that home, is a more powerful force to keep a floor for those kids and give them an opportunity.
But what I would say is,
you could probably definitely speak this as, like, man, with your day-to-day job, man.
Word up, yo. But
explain to them what you do, too, by the way.
Yeah. What I would say, before I get into that, when it comes to the Black family, man, there is no larger minority group, or I would even say race in America, that is churched than Black people in America. That's a fact that I'm willing to argue. Within the Black church, historically, it's always been family. Men, love your wives. Wives, submit to your husband. It was straight up that. That's all we had. It's the Black family. It's a miracle that I can marry a Black wife based upon what has happened to us as far as a genocide, that we're still here. So the Black family, when you see one, that's an act of God that's even there. That's not even supposed to be. We're supposed to be still slaves right now, man. That's a miracle. That's an act of God. So as far as Black family, for our focus not to be on that, that's bugged out, because that's what we treasure. That's all we had at one point. That's all we had. So I would say the African-American people, we're not a monolith. However, we have to fight multiple battles, multiple. We get hit from Democrats, hit from Republicans, because at the end of the day, it's all about money. It's a political thing. But, you know, we fight against ourselves. You know, we have implicit bias against ourselves. I could walk across the street when I see another Black dude coming at me. And what's that? And why does that happen? It's because we are affected by the racialization of America. We are affected by it. We are affected by classism, the father of racism. We are affected by whiteness, which is a myth. You know, you have German, Polish, Anglo, and they're like, you know what? Scratch all of that. Mix together and white, and you're superior. If you elevate yourself and you come together, you can own. You don't have to be treated like that slave. You don't have to be an indentured servant no more. You don't have to do that. You can own that your neighbor, he can now be your slave now. Don't you see? So come together. The superiority, if you look into Bacon's Rebellion, late 1500s, that's how the concept of whiteness comes about. So whiteness capitalized on top of that. And you look at Irish, they were slaves, they were getting whipped, they were getting lynched. They bought into the idea of whiteness. You have Hispanics that are like, are you Hispanic? No, I'm actually white. But that they will prefer whiteness because it gives you a level of superiority. So that right there can affect this country, that country, and it can spread out. It could start apartheid, which it did. Apartheid copied American slavery. It copied these things. So when you have that concept and that myth of white, black, and that superiority still carries on, what that superiority does, it creates fear. Hey, that black man right there, he's going to steal your white wife. Hey, that black man right there, he's free now, but hey, don't trust him. He's a lazy bum. You know what? He's a criminal. Fear him. It makes us fear ourselves, and next thing you know, we're in jails, and it creates this true thing. Now we are, illiterate. Now we are fulfilling the stereotype. That creates an implicit bias. So this act of systemic racism created this implicit bias, and this implicit bias is creating this, the cycle goes on and on. We can continue to feed this implicit bias, and we can continue to feed these dog whistles. It goes on and on and on. And so when it comes down to what issue should we focus on, it's never one issue, because now it's such a cycle. Not only black people are hurt by whiteness, white people are hurt by whiteness, because now you're being treated like us as far as being low socioeconomic come from low socioeconomic areas. When people say, oh, black people, they just want welfare, white people are hurt by that because now they can't eat because they are the ones who actually need welfare. Now you broke. Now you looking for jobs. You can't find jobs. Now you're involved in criminal activity. So the effect of whiteness, superiority, inferiority, let the rich get richer, the low stay lower, they get caught up in what whiteness created. So this whole inferior fact that happened in America, which is an ongoing thing, it affects everybody. So it's no more, how do our African Americans look at this issue? It's now, I hate to say, how do the lower class look at this issue? Because now it's not just Shamari that's affected by it. It's my guy, Ben, who's also affected by it. I may experience it a little differently than he does as far as being oppressed. But me and him, in order to elevate, it can't just be like, all right, how can we elevate? How can African Americans elevate? In order for me to elevate, we all have to elevate. Isn't that sad?
Yeah.
But that's the fact of the matter. That's the fact of the matter.
So wait. I have one question I want to ask Obey before we leave the family idea. Okay. Have you ever been to a black family reunion?
Have I ever been to a black family reunion?
A black family reunion.
That would mean I'd have to be in a black family.
Have you ever been like invited? Like anybody been like, yo, or have you ever seen a black or DJed a black family reunion?
I have not.
Okay, so before you start talking about the black family, you should probably Come check out some of these black family reunions.
When I'm invited, I would love to do that.
I got you, bro.
What I was going to say is that, just to tack on to what they said, though, is some of the statistics regarding the black family, some of those are irrefutable. So I see what you're saying in terms of right. African-American
family. I'm not trying to create a false,
I know, or be rude.
I'm just saying, you know what I'm saying?
I see what you're saying. Divorce, right. To be honest, divorce rates are high amongst all races.
Yeah.
But here's what I would actually...
I'm not, and again, just for those listening, I'm not trying to single out the black culture. It's like, I hate this. I want to see them succeed. I want to support my black brothers and sisters that feel like we need more support. I just want to also... I'm someone that just tries to look at everything a little bit more... objectively, and just like, yeah, more broad. So I'm just like, when you come to me about these things, I'm with you.
And then when someone comes to me with credible claims for this, for these things, I'm just like, this seems like it could be a credible thing just to work on both sides.
I understand what you're saying. Let me, what I would say is that historically, though, I would say that I don't, and what you're referring to really is respectability politics, which is the idea that if we as a community become respectable, then we'll be awarded certain rights and privileges associated with being treated like fair, equal citizens.
Do you feel like I'm asking for that, for black people to respect themselves?
No, let me clarify.
Okay, yeah.
And so in terms of granting African American people rights and freedoms in America, historically, there have always been arguments in terms of, like, if you go all the way back to before Jim Crow, to the black codes, like, right after slavery, during the Reconstruction era, the argument for vacancy laws was that African American people were lazy. Like, I mean, talking about years after slavery, like after working for free, like they were accused of being lazy. Some of the same charges that we hear from conservative voices today were levied against them at that time, such as, you know, look at their families. Of course, after slavery, families had been separated.
They broke up families.
They broke up families and sent your man to Alabama and Georgia.
But Damani, I get that.
Let me finish.
Okay. I apologize for interrupting.
Let's all talk for a minute.
I'm getting a drink real quick.
But I guess what I'm saying is that consistently throughout history, those kinds of criticisms and stereotypes have been held against African Americans before granting them certain freedoms. And I would argue the opposite. I would say, you know, the reason why you're seeing, I think, black fatherlessness in the African American community, if we can see that is an issue, I would say is because of mass incarceration, of which African American people make up a disproportionate number, because not because of drug laws, because of, and I would say, if you're going to have drug laws on the books, fine, but enforce them equally.
Definitely true. Must be done.
Have police in my community the same way you have police in so-and-so's community.
Right.
And so that's my thing. And so, on top of mass incarceration taking African American people, if we look at the trend of culture itself, so we have a tendency of bifurcating African American people into segregated communities, right? Based on looking at their numbers. So we say African American people, oh my God, they're killing each other at rapid rates, 90-something%, but then we forget to look at white Americans who could kill each other at similar rates. Mm-hmm. And so my point is, we can't continue to separate African American people from society. When you look at hip hop, at least as the way it's portrayed in mainstream media, which is the predominant picture of African Americans that you see, what you see are the same things that are being proliferated by America today. I mean, like womanization, the president, hyper violence in military, and like
wars we in right now.
Exactly. I mean, so like what you see by African American people is a reflection. Exactly, a reflection. It's a reflection, I would argue, of what you see in the government. And I would say if you look at the positive numbers and how African American people are trending nationwide, crime is down, divorce rates are down. Like, these are facts, you can't argue. Not only that, but like if you look at the African American, I don't know if it was last year or the year before, but African American women were the number one starters of businesses. If you look at the way that African American women, let me shout out the queens. If you look at the way that African American women are moving into higher education,
right,
in a way that's outpacing their peers,
right,
in the way that they're trending forward, like if you look at all of those things, you see if you historically give African American people a little bit of a foot off my neck, I can do it.
Right.
We can do it. Right. And so I think that my thing is like, how about we, instead of constantly, historically, from the time of slavery, literally go read Thomas Jefferson, the Virginian Papers, it will make you sick. Like the way that he talked about African people and the way that he justified our enslavement through the same rhetoric that you hear.
Yeah.
Like literally you can draw a straight line between the way that people would talk about African Americans today and the way they were talked about during slavery.
It comes from somewhere.
All of those things, there's a straight line of ancestry, antecedents. And so what I'm pointing to is before we start criticizing African American people, let's criticize this motherfucking place. Mm-hmm. How about we start with criticizing America, who owned us for 400 years, and then let's criticize them for the black codes. Let's criticize them for Jim Crow. Mm-hmm. Let's criticize them for all of the things that they've done historically, redlining after Jim Crow. Like show me this book about redlining.
The Color of Law.
Color of Law. People. Read that book. Like it's so explicit the way, even until today, Wells Fargo was just recently, within the past 5 to 10 years.
That's facts.
5 to 10 years investigated for giving African-American people lower loans, even though they had similar circumstances to their white counterparts. So how about before we criticize the black family, which can't be an issue, before we criticize the black infrastructure, before we criticize African-American people for crime, before we criticize all of these things, let's deal with the greater issue. Let's deal with mass incarceration. Let's deal with over-policing and militarized policing in African-American communities. Let's give people a surface to build up from. And if you want to criticize criticism of Barack Obama came to a graduation ceremony in Morehouse when he was first running for president. And he said to these black people who are getting ready to graduate from one of the highest institutions in black life, he said to them, we need more black fathers in the households and we need you to pull up your pants. And it's like, nigga, are you serious?
Are you in the right?
like what, they're getting ready to walk across the stage with a diploma. I'm just saying like, let's, and also keep in mind that the same people who are propagating, when you look at television, right? And you look at these depictions of African-American people in hip-hop, for example, and you see guns and violence. Who owns the record label?
Who searches for the talent to give the platform?
Who searches for the talent to give them the platform? Who, like, we don't own MTV?
Who fronts the check to make it look like they're driving the best cars?
Right, so, like, there have been conscious hip-hop artists who are more talented than some of their gangster rap peers who are not giving this
money. Exactly.
Like people like Kendrick Lamar, I mean, he's there now. People like Common, but if you look at back at Public Enemy, you know what I'm saying?
I was listening to a podcast last night talking about how great podcasts are, and they were talking about how Ice-T had a metal group talking about Cop Killer.
Right.
And then that's when you saw death of a lot of conscious hip hop. Because the police unions were boycotting the cable companies because they owned the same company that was putting out this music. So conscious music isn't profitable, but ignorant music is very profitable.
Right, because you have to remember when you're looking at hip-hop and you're looking at the record sales, there's no way African-American people can account for the record sales in the hip-hop industry.
The most successful hip-hop artists are the ones that cross over and get the white audience.
Exactly.
And Drake, the Migos, the biggest names in hip-hop right now, when they go on those world tours and they're in arenas, it's all white people.
Right, watch who's all in white the people. Seats.
All white people.
Watch who's in Lil the Wayne, seats. Too.
So I'm just saying, like,
Lil Wayne talked about that.
We have to stop looking at the popular narratives and, like, just look at the people that you know. Like, not you. I'm talking about you, general. Look at the African-American people that you know and ask them questions about their family. I guarantee you that even if only their mom is there, their mom is doing her best. Because I think a lot of times, and I talk to a lot of people in different environments, I'm not going to say where, but I talk to a lot of people. I talk to a lot of people who, they not only have they built up certain perceptions and myths about what it means to be poor in America. So there's a perception of poor people in America where they don't do anything, they don't work, they don't fill in the blank. But they also have a preconceived notion of African American people that's kind of like a filter or a shade that colors the way that they see things. So we'll both hear a story about an individual who, let's say, got busted for drugs, right? And they will hear that story and they'll incorporate The Wire, what they've seen from The Wire, what they've seen from all these different shows into validating this drug bust. But when I hear about this drug bust, I'm thinking, man, this brother's family is going to be hurting. It's a different perspective that we're seeing the issue from, because I'm seeing the issue from an individual who I might have known from high school, for example, or from around the way who engaged in illicit activities that are now legal in certain parts of the country. But when they're seeing certain things, they're seeing it from a perspective that from individuals that they don't know. And so I would ask. Anyone who's listening, if you feel in this moment, you know, that you're uneducated or unknowledgeable, you probably are, you should find someone that you can talk to about those issues. And before you go talk to them, read a book so that you don't unpack your baggage on them and traumatize them. Mm-hmm. That's a good idea.
How many books you read?
Don't worry about it.
Somebody?
Not anymore.
That was so good, man. I appreciate you, Imani. So the only thing I would say is... Go ahead. John.
We keep harping on mass incarceration. We keep harping on this prison thing. But I think what really needs to be harped on is where are the black people that are going to be taking advantage in making money off the legalization of cannabis. And then I don't like using marijuana. It's kind of a racially driven term.
I don't know.
Marijuana?
Yeah, hell yeah. Marijuana is a racially driven term.
Word?
Right? Yeah, so like you don't find that used anywhere in history until
Richard Nixon, probably.
No. It was.
You were just naming a president you don't like. I know. Richard Nixon said that he racist.
They changed it to marijuana to sound more Mexican, so they can make it sound like the Mexican immigrants are coming in, and the jazz people are smoking their reefers and making white girls fall in love with them. All this other crazy stuff. But off topic, I think that we talk a lot about the mass incarceration and getting the monkey off our back, and not enough about trying to get the bag off of it.
Mm. Ooh.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, I mean, there's gonna be. I think in next 25 to 50 years, you're going to see a lot of, first off, weed's going to become legal across the U.S. You're going to see a lot of men, young men that were in their 10, 20, who knows how long, go home. And so now that it's legal, I mean, Mike Tyson's got a farm.
They can't make money off of it if they were incarcerated for it.
Yeah.
Right.
At this time.
Right. I mean, again, I understand, like, what's tough about it is that we can never really, as a society, give them back what they lost. I mean, there are guys, they're hoping finally their state will legalize it so they can get out of jail. They've been in there 25 years for a dime bag.
They're not going to get out of jail just because the state legalizes it. That's a whole other battle.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah, it doesn't just automatically happen that way.
Are there nonprofit organizations that are, you know, paying for lawyers to help them? Defense funds?
It's time. It's a lot of time. I think we talk about it like it's very easy, but like it's a lot of time that is behind that.
So are you saying that you feel like now African Americans should step into the cannabis space?
Hell yeah.
And
that's our reparations. Well,
I mean, Mike Tyson's doing it. There's a lot of people in that space. I was listening to Mike Tyson talk about it. I didn't really realize how much money. I went to Colorado and sat with some people. I did not partake that time.
That time.
I was offered. No,
So what time did you partake?
I've only done weed one time. I did an edible, and that was, I was tripped out.
No, I remember you told me about
that. Yeah, that was. I just got more goofy, and I
do not engage in the use
of
sale.
I will say this. I will say this part of the story. I was so high that I walked upstairs, and this is like, I was like joking, like, yo, I'm not high. Like, this is stupid. Why do people do weed? This is dumb. And of course, I was high. And I started just in someone else's home that I was at, eating food that was not mine. And the moment I knew I was high, I turned around, and the person that I was staying there with, I baked the cake. With some of that I come there with.
The views and expressions of this podcast are not shared. The host or the production team.
Did you take some of your plate one time?
That time I was sober. No, but like it was crazy because like I
just grabbed
the cake. I looked at the cake and I have never acted like this in my life in someone else's home. I just wanted that cake so bad. My mind was just like, this is going to be the greatest cake of my life. I put my whole hand in and not even a normal person. I just started like, all over my lips, my shirt.
The stories that are shared in this podcast are fictional in nature. Should not be taken seriously.
Hey, it's like, it's all good. He works for himself now.
Like the person that I come to with, turn on the light, and they're just like, what are you doing? And I was like,
bro, just remember that when you run for something in like 10, 15 years, they're going to come to you and be like, so, this podcast.
They're not going to be mad about the fact that you were smoking. They're going to be mad about the fact
I wasn't smoking.
They're not going to be mad about the fact that you did an edible. They're going to be mad about the way you ate that cake.
That's true. That's true.
How can you trust a man?
That's true.
How can you trust a man?
This man, Obey, cannot be trusted with this state. The way he dug his hand in that cake. I'll just be like, Brock. A little bit of weed. Nothing wrong with that. A little bit of cake. Nothing wrong.
And then the allegation gonna pop off. Another cake gonna come out and say he touched me. This
another. There have been three bakers that have come forward. Yeah.
Pillsbury Doughboy come out.
What cake was he grabbing?
Pillsbury Doughboy come out.
Three bakers.
Three bakers. CNN
is doing
wall to wall coverage. Wall to wall coverage. We have a fourth woman who says Obey did come in, have a cookie, and eat the cookie without paying tip for the. Like it would have been.
This man out here, Santa Claus and the cookies.
Oh shoot, that is too freaking funny, man. Oh my gosh.
Damn, Obey, you've been working out
Bro, my bad, bro. My bad. You look at the guns you're working with. Nah, come on now. Man, this was good. Definitely. I really like. This is one of the things I want all the fans of this podcast to listen to. Like, I love that in real life you're able to have really great friendships. Like I have with Shamari, who used to cut my hair, Damani, Chad. Like these guys are just like some of my brothers here. And I just love that they grow your perspective. Some of the books that they've offered me to read and the things that I'm definitely going to read that Thomas Jefferson, the Virginia Papers. I just have so many books and articles that I've been like consuming from them, and it's really helped me grow my perspective. I mean, when I met them, I was like, I don't really know. I think criminal justice is fine. I'm just someone that just stays out of trouble. But I, through reading some of the great books that they had offered me to read, it was incredible how I began to understand their perspective and understand that these things are not okay. There needs to be restorative justice. We all need to be a part of restorative justice. I believe in the home and outside the home for the African American community as well as other communities around the U.S. You know, but yeah, this has been really, really, really good. And is there like anything else y'all want to touch on? Like, yeah, when it comes down to what I said about whiteness, I do know people do identify as white, and
do you believe that you can identify as other races?
You know what? You know what? No. All
right. So
check this out. I'm white. This is what I'm saying right now.
This is what I'm going to say.
Show, please. I'm getting scared. I'm getting.
Oh my
God. No. I want him to talk about it. Like, this is what. Like, transracialism is one of the craziest things.
You'd be great in media because that's not even what he was trying to say.
Are you kidding me? Like, this man just said whiteness is identity. Like, you can identify as white.
Right. So, when historically, when people chose to do that, it was. As far as upward mobility, ownership, to take advantage of the New Deal when FDR was giving out breaks for everybody, when different programs were coming into play for a specific demographic of people. During that time, people began to hold tightly to that whiteness, which is a myth because whiteness, that's not an ethnicity, that's a race. And we all know race is a what? Social construct. So what I want to say to those who do identify as white, go ahead and look it back into your lineage because you're going to be able to identify
with... Rachel Dolezal, please pay attention to this segment.
But just for those who do identify as white...
All my white people out here.
You will be able to, if you want, you can go ahead and trace back your lineage. If you're Irish, if you're Polish, if you're German, if you're this, if you're that, you'll be able to see what that people group has experienced and gone through. So you can better identify with today's current people who are targeted and being treated at a disproportionate rate in certain areas, whether it's housing, whether it's criminalization, whether it's through education, through the achievement gap or access gap, school to prison pipeline. You'll be able to. I'm just out here searching for empathy. That's what I'm doing. That's all thing I want is empathy, to empathize. And with the other side, the right side, the conservative side, my only strike against them is the empathy. And I would encourage you guys to go ahead and check out a book. It's called The Conservative Heart. It has a flag on the cover of the book, but it talks about how Republicans can be more empathetic to causes that the left or Democrats have because they are running the race of the empathy, you know, party, which that may not be the case the whole time. Don't let them be the people that run the race with that. But divest, if you want to divest from whiteness, look to what your lineage is, and you'll be able to connect with groups today. I would recommend you go check out Akemini Uwan, her Sparrow Conference talk about divesting from whiteness. It's a tough talk, and it's hard, but as a country, as Americans, we won't be able to move forward, and moving forward is tough. It hurts. Growth hurts. It's called growing pains. It's gonna be tough. That's one of the one things I want to say.
Awesome. Well, Shamari, you gave us a lot to kind of unpack, and I wish we had enough time. But I want to do a part two. Y'all okay with doing a part two?
Yeah.
Can I ask you a question?
I'm not sure I agree.
Yeah, that's we gotta sit on that. I think it was good. We will do a part two. We'll touch on some more things because I would love to have you guys back on. You guys were just amazing. I just really enjoy this.
Is this the most black people you've had on your podcast?
Is that probably the second episode?
So
yes. I'm just curious.
Cool. Is it okay that I had an Asian American before you?
I saw that. It wasn't a shot, bro. I wanted to celebrate
this moment. He is lighter than you, so
I wanted to celebrate this moment with all of us here. You feel me? Like
all of us as brothers,
exactly.
If you can like get a picture of us like just like right here on the mics, that'll be so meaningful for me.
Yeah.
And y'all do everything you're not supposed to. Y'all be talking to Drew off camera when you're eating.
hey, Drew, I appreciate you. Shout out to Drew. Oh,
this is raw.
Shout out to Drew, bro.
Yeah, this is raw.
This is raw. Yeah, yeah. Man, before all the mics and all that, what do we have?
What
do we have? Man, exactly, each other.
All right.
Wow. Did you get my
face? Y'all give us Drew so much edit work. Thank you, Drew. All right, so to the Sojourners listening to this, thank you guys so much for listening. We gave you a lot to discuss. You know, my heart, again, with this podcast is that you would take the topics and the discussions that we had here into your communities, into your friend groups, into your social circles, and have those discussions. Have these tough discussions and find good friends that will push you like I have in Damani, in Chad, and in Shamari. And I hope that you guys would find some fruitful perspective, some great books, some great articles to listen to. If you listen to audiobooks, but yeah, books to read and articles to read. That white...
Color Lines?
The last one that you gave?
Red Lining.
Shamari?
Yeah, lining? Man, The Color of Law. Go ahead and check that.
No, the other one that you did with white, divesting from whiteness.
Divesting from whiteness.
That article was sent to me, and I'm definitely going to read it now because you brought it up, and I have it in queue to read, and it was something that I was like,
it's a Sparrow Conference talk. Sparrow Conference is a woman conference, and Ekemini Uwan is the one who led that talk.
Okay.
She kind of solidified something that I felt for years out of a few of my studies at Liberty in my cultural development classes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well,
I listened to it as well. I just have some questions.
All right.
Hey, download Tidal. I'm talking about my man Obey a sponsorship. Make sure once y'all download Tidal, you look at Peace Corps, spelled CORE.
Sojourners, we will have a part two. Thank you guys for checking this podcast out. I appreciate y'all. Make sure you like, share, subscribe, follow, share this with someone, have these conversations. Enjoy it. See till next time. Bye.